You're listening to Critical Reads. This show is designed to help people critically analyze topics like race, culture, and faith, one resource at a time. I am your host, Neff Lesperance. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another exciting episode of Critical Reads, a podcast. As the intro says, I'm your host, Neff. And for those of you who are joining me for the first time, welcome to the show. And for those of you who have been rocking with me since the beginning, welcome back. It's always great to have you back here again. As promised, this is part two of the episode that I've entitled A Medical Apartheid. As I said in the last episode, because the creator just had so many really great content and different things for me to digest in this book, I thought it would be very difficult to get everything that I thought into an hour and a half, and also to make you guys sit through more than an hour and a half. I just felt like it wasn't going to be fair to you all. So similar to what I did with another episode that I did with my friend Diane, Promising Young Woman, I decided to break it up to a part one, part two type of thing. And so, as promised, here is part two. And I hope that you really get to enjoy just more of my thoughts on this book. And just a quick note, if you haven't listened to part one yet, please pause for a second. Stop everything that you're doing with this episode and go back, listen to part one. And then you can always come back to this episode and finish it up, just so that you can really have some context to what the heck I'm talking about in this episode. And you're not just jumping in at this weird middle point. So without further ado, now that we've gotten past all the little intro stuff, here's part two. I hope you guys really enjoy my commentary and my take on reading this book, Medical Apartheid. And another thing that kind of just stood out to me in this first chapter was just like all of the different mythologies and scientific / like biblical things that they kind of came up with to be like, this is why we're going to keep slavery. This is why it's okay to keep treating these Black people this way. And obviously, Miss Washington did kind of highlight a lot of different ways that these scientists/doctors kind of filled like their medical journals and textbooks with like documentation kind of saying how like, you know, Black people are different and inferior to white people. But I just wanted to take a minute to kind of note a few of them that kind of stood out to me, because I think what we often forget is that these people were like proud of this stuff. They wrote this, they said it with their whole chest. And then, you know, here we are in the future and people keep trying to be like, oh, no. Like, they didn't mean it like that. You know, they really were trying to care for these people. They treated them with the best that they could. It's like, no. Like, they again, proudly put this stuff out here. They were making money off of it. They said what they said. They meant what they meant to say, right? So these little ploys to kind of believe the best about these people is just complete another bullshit, right? So again, let me just quickly go through some of them that kind of stood out to me. So first one that stood out to me was by this guy named Morton. In 1839, he published something called The Crania Americana, which is a book written to demonstrate how the human skull measurements indicated a hierarchy of racial types. And in this book, Morton kind of determined that Caucasians had the largest skulls and therefore the largest brains, and Blacks the smallest. His tests were the forerunner of like phrenology, which sought to determine character and intelligence by interpreting the shape of the skull. And so I don't know a lot about phrenology. I mean, I think digging a little deeper into this would be like a cool thing for me to do on my free time. But I would imagine that a lot of the times, like, you know, just with your skulls and all that stuff, like, that's probably just determined by like your body type. I wouldn't imagine that we have really that much of a difference between like our brains. Like, I feel like a lot of our organs are probably, you know, somewhat similar sizes. You know, maybe you might see some differences in like body structure and shape depending on your race and ethnicity, just because, you know, we're built different, which is not a bad thing. But I would imagine that most of your organs and stuff are pretty much the same. So for you to be like able to be like, oh, let's determine your character and your intelligence based off of that, I think that was a very bold move by this man, especially because I think a lot of intelligence, a lot of that stuff is like kind of subjective, because, you know, everybody's intelligence is kind of different. So with me, like, if you ask me to talk about like science and math and stuff, like my intelligence with that, it's only going to go so far because I don't give a shit about it as much, you know, or even like law, like stuff like that. Like, it's not really my forte. But if you ask me about more other things, like maybe emotional intelligence, maybe anti-racism a little bit, you know, maybe theology, there's some other areas where I'm like, yeah, I'm more versed in this because it's my area of interest. Like, during my free time, I'm reading all these different books about those topics because it's interesting to me. So in those areas, like, I might be a little bit more intelligent in them, but it's because I take a lot of my free time to read and to learn and to do all this stuff in it. While, you know, some other people, it might be in something else, right? So that was interesting, you know, for this man to make these assertions, right? And then next, Miss Washington talks about a man named Samuel Cartwright, who was from Louisiana. And he wrote a bunch of different things, but she highlights first that in 1848, he wrote a book that was entitled The Diseases and Physical Peculiarities of the Negro Race, where he supported his widely read claims of Black inferiority with a mixture of biblical lore and scientific theories that were very popular in his time. And so in this, Cartwright suggested that Blacks' physical and mental defects made it impossible for them to survive without white supervision and care. Sorry, that's funny. He also alleged that the cranium of Blacks was 10% smaller than that of whites, preventing full development of the brain and causing a stunting of intellect. So that was really interesting to me because, again, I genuinely do believe, regardless of the size of your cranium and all that stuff, I would imagine most of our brains are relatively around the same size. So again, I don't know how accurate I am because science isn't my thing, but I was like, okay, dude, sure. And then, but let's move forward to some more malarkey that these people come up with, because I'm sorry, but this shit kind of makes me laugh. In another paper this man wrote in 1850, Cartwright insisted that whites and blacks differed so dramatically that the same medical treatment which would benefit or cure a white man would often injure or kill a Negro. This universal belief in uniquely black diseases led doctors and planters to clamor for a textbook on medical care of blacks, but such a book was not written until almost a century later. And so that one kind of was interesting to me too, because the whole premise of this book is the fact that a lot of these people use black bodies to come up with medical treatment and then eventually use those same medical treatments to treat white people. So for me, I'm like, if, you know, black diseases and, you know, everything about us is so dramatically different that we can't have the same medical treatment, then why the hell are you essentially using the same medical treatment that you're creating from us on your own people? You know, the logic here is just not here. But again, this is the kind of shit that these people believed and went with. I think the funniest stuff, and I'm only saying funny because I can't I just can't process this any other way. But the funniest stuff is what this man wrote in 1851. And so Miss Washington kind of writes the following. By 1851, Cartwright had also discovered and described a host of imaginary black diseases whose principal symptoms seemed to be a lack of enthusiasm for slavery. Escape might have seemed normal behavior for a slave in ancient Greece or Rome, but Cartwright medically condemned such behavior in American blacks, offering a diagnosis of drapetomania, from the Greek words for flight and insanity. Hebetude was a singular laziness or shiftlessness that caused slaves to mishandle and abuse their owner's property. Dystasia ethiopica was another black behavioral malady which was characterized by a desire to destroy the property of white slave owners. Cachexia africana referred to blacks' supposed propensity for eating non-food substances such as clay, chalk, and dirt. Actually, this disorder, which is called pica today, is not racially specific, and the cravings it inspires were merely related to the rampant malnutrition among slaves. Tellingly, Dr. Cartwright recommended that these ailments be treated with corporal punishment or with internment in work camps. Sorry, first of all, for trying to read these Greek and Roman, Latin, whatever words, because LOL, that was tough. But the point is that Dr. Cartwright basically was coming up with bullshit to like normal reactions to abuse and normal reactions to not wanting to be a slave. And I love that Miss Washington basically says, like, obviously, if we look at the people in ancient Rome and Greece, and even if we look at these precious Puritans that were like, hey, you know, the way I'm being treated in Britain isn't okay. It's time to turn up and get out of here. Like, we look at those people and we're like, yeah, good for them. They stood up for themselves. They got out of there. But of course, if these slaves try to do that, automatically it's like, oh, they have a mental illness. Oh, there's something wrong with them. Oh, how dare they not want to accept the abuse of their owners? How dare they try to, you know, destroy property and blah, blah, blah. And of course, like, as I was reading this again, it's hard not to chuckle at like the absurdity of this, but then it's like, these people really believe this shit. Like, you know what I mean? And so it's crazy. And even I feel like, again, there's a remnant of this today. It's like when we see black people in these streets, like what people call looting and rioting and all this stuff. And it's like, how do you not want to do that? Like, how are you guys, I guess the word is like, how are you guys surprised at the natural reaction to abuse and to mistreatment is that the person wants to like revolt, the person wants to destroy things, the person wants to do whatever they can to kind of inspire something else to happen. They don't want to just sit by and accept the abuse, right? But again, you know, anytime people are trying to protest and whatever, especially again around BLM, the natural reaction is to be like, oh, there's something wrong with them. Look at them. They don't care about their community. Look at this and that. But it's like, no, like, this is a natural reaction. Like, you would see anybody who's dealing with abuse, who's dealing with oppression, not want to just sit back and take it and accept it, right? So it's just crazy, again, to see like how these people were doing backflips to kind of just justify this, right? I think another thing that made me chuckle was there was another physician named Josiah Knott from Mobile, Alabama. He wrote this book with another person named George Glidden entitled Types of Mankind. And in it, like, he wrote this in 1854, and basically these people claim that blacks' physical and mental differences kind of signaled their polygenetic origins and kind of proved their inferiority. And so, for example, Knott kind of theorized that the distinctive knee joint and the long heel of Black men prove that he was created to be a submissive knee bender or a servant to the whites. So, again, that made me laugh. And then, you know, as these people are coming up with their bullshit, they continue to like kind of take a lot of times to just note the differences in these people compared to them and just kind of, you know, do whatever they can to use that as the means to justify that they're meant to be slaves, right? And then just as a side note, I did kind of crack up because they did kind of note in this book about the reality of like apes and chimpanzees, like supposedly Black people are supposed to be connected with them. But I did laugh that Mrs. Washington kind of noted that, you know, these people kind of ignored the fact that apes and chimpanzees kind of have really thin lips. And most of the times, like African Americans, you know, we do not have thin lips. That's usually like a white people thing. Oh, God. So that part, sorry, kind of killed me because I was like, ooh. Nobody did like the fact checking on that one. But I love that she kind of like subtly added that drag in the midst of all of this stuff. Because, again, it's just stupid. And I don't even know anymore about this whole debate about like creationism versus evolution and maybe God did both. I don't even care at this point. But again, to the fact that these people are just reaching so hard to justify their racism was just ridiculous to me. And then lastly, I hated, but I also was reminded by the fact that a lot of these people, scientists and blah, 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 kind of also look at like biblical stuff to justify this. And so I wanted to kind of highlight that. And so Miss Washington notes in this chapter the following: to fully justify enslavement, scientists such as Knott had to turn from their naturalist texts to their Bibles, from which they deduce that Blacks were the children of Ham, son of Noah, who along with his progeny was marked and condemned to be servant to his brothers for having viewed his father's nakedness. Other similar biblical justifications were found, and Knott even ventured into a twisted ethical high road when he insisted that yellow fever and malaria were visited upon whites as divine punishment for not enslaving Blacks. He insisted that non-slaving whites contracted these diseases as a result of usurping the natural Black role as laborers in the fields. Pragmatic planters and politicians ignored the religious moralization, but embraced the useful fact that Black slaves were the only logical medical choice for backbreaking labor in their sunny fields. And so this was very interesting to me because Mrs. Washington kind of also explained in this chapter, and this is all chapter one, but she explains in this chapter how a lot of the white people were realizing that basically their skin was not designed to do this labor, both in Africa and a lot of these southern states, because of how hot it was. But of course, African Americans or Black people or Africans, like they were able to do this work because their skin and everything else, you know, that it was kind of designed to deal with this heat, right? And so as they were, you know, noting all of this, they kind of justify, well, of course it's okay for us to enslave them because their skin is designed to deal with this, you know, and it's our God-given, you know, right to kind of do this to them. And if we're not doing this, then we're not following God's rules. And, you know, again, they do all this mental gymnastics to make this okay. But really what it came down to is we want to make our money. We want to maintain our wealth. And the only way that we can do that is working these fields. And the only person that can really do that is these Blacks and not us. And so again, I just loved how Mrs. Washington's book kind of like highlighted the stupidity of all this and the mental gymnastics that they had to do to justify like their greed, to justify their desires to till the land and make money without actually having to break their backs and do anything, right? And it's really funny too, again, because Mrs. Washington does another like subtle like jab towards them again, where she was saying like, even despite all of these, you know, scientific and biblical grounds that they kind of made up for their racism and how, you know, whites are more superior to blacks and blacks are made to like be subservient and bend their knees to the whiteness and all this stuff, like they still used black people in like very responsible positions. So like she notes that they were like often nurses, cooks, herbalists, midwives, overseers, leaders of their work, you know, accountants, operators of their farms and their factories. Even, you know, in the future, a lot of these slaves or these black freed black people ended up making inventions. And of course, like these people profited off of these black people inventing things. The same thing with like the apprentices, like a lot of these people were apprentices to physicians and a lot of these other positions. And they trusted these people to do this stuff, you know, even to the point where like she was mentioning like white households really depended on these slaves to kind of survive, you know, from like rearing the children to everything else. So it's like, on one hand, you guys are talking all this shit and saying that, you know, black people ain't shit and they ain't ever gonna do nothing and they ain't smart enough and all this stuff, but then you're using them for your survival. And so again, it was like a subtle like jab at like their logic, but at the same time, I was like, yeah, like, this is nuts, you know? And I think that's the thing that's so crazy about this stuff is like when you're being abused, you know, and you're really going through it with people that are abusing you, like you don't always realize your power. Like a lot of the times the bullies and the abusers, like they need you more than they need them, but they just keep telling you shit to make you feel like you really need them. But at the end of the day, like if you're not there, they're really nothing. You know what I mean? And I think that's the hard thing about these conversations sometimes as a black person is like, we don't even recognize like our own power and our strength and how much like these colonizers, aka white people now, are like, they really need us. You know, they really need us to you know, provide content to make them feel good and all this other shit. But because they're not dealing with their internal stuff, like it's hard for us to like have a better society because they're so caught up in like torturing and tormenting us and bullying and all this other stuff that we're never going to get anywhere. And I'm not just saying this to be an asshole, but I think that's the reality as I was reflecting on this book of like, that's what bullying is. Like a lot of the times when you look at bullies, you can see like they have their internal stuff that they're going on. And instead of dealing with it, they're projecting. They take out their hurt on other people, other groups of people. And they never really do the internal work that they need to do to like actually get better, you know? And so unfortunately, that's kind of where we are with white people. And until white people actually do their internal work and recognize like there's something in me that feels like I need to bully a group of people so I can feel better about myself, I don't know if that's ever going to happen. And I think as I'm, you know, thinking about this too, I'm reminded of another book that I want to do eventually called, it's called My Grandmother's Hands, and it's about trauma. And one of the things that he brings up in it, I think, or like from a podcast I listened to with him talking, he was saying a lot of the times, like, we don't recognize too, like white people went through their own trauma that they never processed. Like black people have their generational trauma, but white people have it too. And I think as I'm reading this book, you know, I'm reminded of the fact that white people, you guys from another country, from the British, they abused you. You went through a lot of trauma from smallpox to all these different crazy things that happen. And again, it was not addressed. You know, the bullying that was done to those group of white people were never addressed. And then they, like, in turn, came to a whole new world and just bullied the hell out of anything that was breathing that was in their way instead of dealing with it. And I think that is, for me, why it's so important for us to be going to therapy and doing our work. Because if we're not healing from the stuff that was done to us, it's so easy for us to turn around and do that stuff to other people. You know what I'm saying? And so, and again, it's not to erase the responsibility that white people have to do, or it's not to dissolve you of your responsibility, I should say. But it's to recognize, like, there's shit here. There's crap. There's generational crap that needs to be uncovered and dealt with, or else we're going to keep going through this circular motion, you know? And I think given that whiteness and white people have a history of, like, not being accountable to anything and just being able to sweep stuff under the rug, you know, it's kind of hard for us to, like, really address those things until we stop doing that. And I think even this book even highlights it too. Like, there was so much stuff that was done to these African Americans, and I think the Native Americans she brought up as well. But instead of there being, like, an honest reckoning and really dealing with it, I mean, there was, like, one or two ceremonious, like, plaques, but, and then, like, a lot of, like, sweeping under the rug and pretending nothing happened. And that's why we're here still. That's why nothing has really changed. And that, unfortunately, is why, you know, we're never going to see changes in the medical profession towards people of color, towards Black people, because we're not really taking an honest look at what's going on. And lastly, on this topic, I did also like that she talked about the fact that even though white people always called these people, like, primitive, there was a point where white people, especially white women, were looking towards African healers and African American midwives because their African techniques and herbs and medicines were a lot less dangerous than the crap that white people were doing here. Even to the point that African healers were the first to kind of use citrus juice to deal with scurvy and smallpox and some of the other viral illnesses that were rampant. So again, we're so inferior, but at the same time, like, we're the ones that are, like, bringing a lot of the stuff onto the table. So You got to pick one. You can't be both, right? And again, it's not to say that, you know, this is saying that Black people are more superior than whites or anything. I think all of us have great qualities in us when we look at, like, the different races and cultures and background. We all have great things that we bring to the table. But again, I just hate this whole thing of, like, oh, we're so superior from you, but then at the same time, we're going to take everything that you create, everything that you're using, everything to kind of make our world and society better. But at the same time, you're not as superior as we are. That doesn't make any sense. But again, I don't think white logic like this ever does make any sense. But that's for another time. And so the next thing I wanted to kind of talk about real quickly was this guy, James Marion Sims. And there's a lot to be said about this character. But first, I want to start by just sharing a little bit about who he was from the author's perspective, and then we'll kind of go from there. So about this guy, Miss Washington says the following. James Marion Sims is an important figure in the history of experimentation with African Americans because he so well embodies the dual face of American medicine, to which racial health disparities owe so much. Sims is revered as a woman's benefactor, although he conducted years of nightmarishly painful and degrading experiments without anesthesia or consent on a group of slave women. He was born into a struggling family of 10 in Hanging Rock near Lancasterville, South Carolina in 1813. In his autobiography, The Story of My Life, Sims describes how, despite a career as an indifferent, mediocre student, he gained entrance first to South Carolina Medical College and then to Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia. In the manner of the day, his medical education consisted of a year and a half of instruction. Sims confessed that he initially found his medical training wanting. When it came time to make up a prescription, I had no more idea of what to do than if I never studied medicine. But once he embarked upon practice on the plantations of Alabama, these feelings of inadequacy did not prevent him from blaming enslaved mothers for the high death rates of their infant children. He ascribed neonatal tetanus to the mother's moral and intellectual failures. Neonatal tetanus is caused by a bacterial infection with Clostridium tetani, which emanates from animal manure and thrives in wounds such as healing umbilical stumps. Thus, Sims perceived the connection between filth and illness, which was not yet an accepted medical belief, but he blamed the wrong parties. Owners built slave shacks on inferior lands near horse stables and other quarters, and as far as possible from white dwellings. Antebellum doctors disdained for hand washing as well as the midwifery practice of swaddling the umbilical cord with rags raised the risk of infection. But by attributing tetanus to the laziness and weakness of slaves, he deflected attention from the simplest way of removing contagion, relocating and improving slave dwellings. Today we know the deaths were probably the caregiver's fault. And so I read this because there was a lot that popped out at me, just the beginning of this man's journey. First, you know, he had a struggling family of 10, whatever, and he wanted to make a name for himself. So already you see there's this like, woe is me, you know, my life was hard. You can tell, like, just because of what happened to him when he was young and the fact that he was struggling, everything that he did from that moment forward was about making a name for himself, making money, wealth, blah, 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 even at the cost of the slave women that he violated. So as much as, you know, part of me was like, oh, that sucks that he went through it, I was like, no, that still was not an excuse for you to be a piece of shit. And then I cracked up because, like, basically, he himself even says that he was a very, like, indifferent, mediocre student. And then he still got entrance into a lot of these different prestigious schools. And even after barely making it through school and, you know, not feeling qualified still, he still felt like he knew a lot about how to treat these people and what was wrong with them. And for me, I was like, if that isn't an example of, like, white male mediocrity, I don't know what else is. Because, you know, the fact that this man, he's not even qualified, really, to know what the hell he's talking about, but yet he still has an opinion. Oh my gosh, like, I'm sorry, but that had me chuckling. You know, I had to read it twice so I could chuckle some more, because this, just from the jump, this man, you know, told on himself. Like, he wasn't qualified. He didn't know really what he was talking about, what he was doing. And I also hated, like, this account of, like, you know, they blamed these African-American women for, you know, oh, you're not intelligent enough, you're not moral enough, and this is why your kid is dying. But what it really came down to it is, like, they didn't even have, like, safe conditions and healthy conditions to have their kids in a way that will help them thrive. And that's something that I even see in the present day as a social worker, where a lot of the times we're blaming, like, African-American women, poor whites, Hispanic women, anybody that's not, like, making it in, like, the what's, like, the classist slash elitist bubble of living, it's always like, oh, it's their own personal failure. It's their own, you know, morality that's causing this. But a lot of it is like, no, you're not giving them good schools. You're not giving them access to resources that they need to survive. A lot of the times people's neighborhoods contribute to their health concerns, especially when you think about like the fact that a lot of our country has like food deserts where they don't even have access to good food. So it's like, oh, why does this person have high blood pressure and blah, 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 blah all the time? But it's like, look at what you gave them. Like the nearest grocery store is like really far away. People don't have access to cars and all this stuff in the same way that some of us who, you know, may have more resources can have access to that stuff, right? And then, you know, what you give them instead is like liquor store, all these fast food restaurants, like all this different stuff. So if, even if they want to eat healthy, what options are there for them? What options are available for them? And I know even in my time in Chicago, there were some neighborhoods where they were starting to put Whole Foods in it. And I'm like, on average, like some of the people in some of the neighborhoods that I was in would make like maybe $7,000 to $10,000 a year. I make probably like what, maybe $50,000? And I can't be affording to go to Whole Foods like that all the time. Like Whole Foods is like a treat sometimes, or for certain foods that I really like, because right now I am having a gluten sensitivity. So maybe if every once in a while, like I'll go to Whole Foods for a certain thing, because I know it, with my insensitivity, I could find stuff that has the things that I need so I don't get sick, right? But that's only for like a few items here and there. I'm not doing my whole bulk of a shopping. So can you imagine somebody that only makes like between $7,000 to $10,000 a year to try to make it work out of Whole Foods? Yeah, that's not going to cut it. So again, I just saw more remnants of, oh yeah, let's blame these groups of people for some shit that we're responsible for, but we don't want to own and say we're responsible for. So yeah, so just that part of his story was already like, oh God, this guy's a piece of shit. And then moving forward, when they talk more about some of the stuff that he did and all that, I'm not going to go deep into everything that he did, because I'm going to be honest, like when I was reading it, and especially since it's around the vagina part of the body, like a lot of it made me clench, because I just can't imagine like doing stuff down there without anesthesia, especially considering like there's a lot of sensitive parts down there. And I know I mentioned before on this podcast, like just getting a pap smear done was rough, like for me. And I know women do this all the time, but I found it super uncomfortable and I hated every moment of it. So I can't imagine like, you know, going through all these incisions and all the stuff that this man put these women through without like antiseptics, without anything to clean. Because I know the author even mentions like, the hygiene stuff was abysmal too back then. So I can't imagine all that, right? It's bad. But the main takeaway from this area or this chapter is that there was this condition that was called vesicovaginal vesicula, which is an abnormal opening that forms between the bladder and the wall of your vagina. And basically this was happening to women who had like a very difficult childbirth. And I think from what I've understood of this, sometimes this would happen, especially when these doctors were using forceps and different things like that. And so especially for a lot of these women, like this condition ended up being like just something that was like incredibly like embarrassing, and just, you know, it ended up almost making them like incontinent, if I remember correctly. And so obviously like there was this really big pull to figure out something to kind of, you know, help cure this thing, right? And so unfortunately there is a slave woman whose name was Anarka, who had this condition kind of like happen to her. And Dr. Sims saw this as an opportunity to use her body and the body of other enslaved African American women to do a bunch of surgeries and to do a bunch of different experiments to kind of figure out ways to address some of these, you know, gyno needs. And I, from my understanding of this even, is that he saw this as an opportunity to kind of advance his career to kind of help figure this shit out, which, you know, similar to some of the other doctors of this time, that's kind of was part of their motivating factors a lot of the time, is that they're like, oh, there's this need. Okay, let me see if I can take these slave bodies and do what I want with them to find the answers and then, you know, produce shit and, you know, basically make money and power and prestige and all that stuff, right? So that's something that's unfortunately a consistent thing that kind of happens throughout these different narratives and sadly is kind of still happening now, right? So through these different experimentations and different things like that, you know, long story short, he does end up finding some ways to kind of help, like, cure these different ailments. But the reality is that this psychopath basically did all of these different things to these women without their consent, without any anesthetics. You know, they're screaming and wailing throughout the whole procedure. People have to, like, force them down. And there's even a point in this journey that the author notes that he not only was like holding people down, but, you know, he had other doctors that were holding people down. And those doctors got to a point where they were like, yo, this is too much. And so they left. So eventually he had other slave women holding each other down, right? And so that was, again, really hard for me to read. I was like, wow. And again, there was a lot of clenching because I can't even imagine, like, having to be a woman that's going through that. And despite your screams and your prayers for help and all that stuff, like, none of that is coming, you know? And the crazy part of the story, too, is there's a point where, like, anesthesia started coming up, right? And they said that this was around like the 1860s. So this is like a few years into his work, anesthesia started coming out. And he still refused to use that, even though, like, it's clear that these women are in pain. And his response is, oh, well, blacks handle pain different than white women, right? And so he would still be using, like, you know, anesthesia for white women, but he would not choose to use it for these black women. So I know that the author kind of considered him a sadist, but I would also say this man is a psychopath because I can't even imagine, like, what the world would possess you to do something like that to another human being, especially considering, like, you know, one of the main things of being a doctor is that you're trying to do no harm. You're trying to do the best that you can to help other people as best as you can. And I don't know if maybe this do no harm thing came a lot later. And, you know, at that time it was just like, it's a free for all. But yikes. Again, this chapter was horrible to read. And I think one of the things that stood out to me as the last thing about this guy is the author notes that, you know, he didn't want to give anesthesia to these black women that he was doing this horrible stuff to. But there was a point where this guy, Sims, there was like white women who are patients that were struggling with this thing called vaginismus. And this is basically a disorder where, you know, you have like very painful vaginal contractions. So it kind of prevents you from allowing the penis to enter you. So that means like intercourse is very painful, which if you struggle with that, I'm so sorry. Essentially, she was saying that there was a lot of husbands that were complaining that this was happening. And Sims chose to use this anesthesia on their wives so that they can be unconscious so that these husbands can have sex with them. And Again, reading this shit, I'm like, what? But I was just shocked that that was a practice. Like, I had to read that twice because I was like, wait, what? They really did this? And, but again, like, A, it shows like he really didn't have a problem with using anesthesia because he's using it for shit like this. But then also, I'm like, men of this time, what the hell? And I'm hoping that these women actually consented to this. But I also know that, you know, women in the past also had no rights. So I feel like reading this as like a throwaway, like, paragraph in this thing was like, oh my God, I have so many questions and concerns. And also, like, you know, when we try to say we want to go back to how it was in the past when America was great, I'm like, this America? Like, where we're out here just willy-nilly doing experimentation on people without anesthesia and then also letting women be knocked unconscious to have sex. I don't know. This was a lot for me to process about this man. But basically, Sims was a piece of shit, and like he would, you know, do these things on these women. And then at some point too, he ended up like also getting these slave women addicted to morphine because he would give them morphine after his horrible procedures because he didn't want them to try to run away or resist him. And so again, like just having to see like how this man did all of this horrible stuff, and then he became known as like the father of gynecology, and he I think eventually went on to like having his own like clinic and all this stuff. This was a weird chapter to kind of like wrestle with and sit with. And I think the thing that the author kind of notes, which I was like, this is a good point, is the fact that although African American bodies were used and abused and all that stuff for all of these different procedures and stuff to be, I guess, perfected and made readily available for most women, African Americans are also the group of people that don't really necessarily get the benefit from this. Because later on in this book, Miss Washington kind of brings up the fact that there's a lot of countries overseas, I think in Africa and stuff like that, where they are suffering from this disease, VIZO, called vaginal fistula. And they're not getting treatment. They're not getting access to this treatment readily available to them, even though the bodies of their ancestors were used to, like, get this stuff figured out. And so the author is using this point to note that throughout this book, there's this theme of, like, African American bodies were constantly used and abused to find all these different treatments and procedures and to kind of make the medical field what it is. But then at the same time, African American bodies are the ones that have the least amount of like equal access to these medical facilities and to these medical treatments. So that was really interesting. This guy is still a piece of shit. And it sucks that, like, you know, I don't know. It's like this weird like wrestling that you have to do, which it's like, oh, like as a woman, I'm like, oh, thank God there's answers to handle some of this stuff. But the things that happened for those things to exist, it's hard to sit with because it's not like I'm going to be here high-fiving this man. I think this guy is truly a psychopath and a horrible human being for what he did to these women. But then at the same time, it's like, we wouldn't have any of this stuff if he didn't do it. And I hate that. Like, it's not even that I'm saying that this was a good thing. I hate that this is the world that we live in. Like, that's the reality of the thing. Like, we wouldn't have had this stuff if this guy wasn't a monster. And I hate that, you know. And I don't even know if there's not even anything we can say, you know, moving forward from this. It's just, it was just a hard chapter to sit with, is what I'm trying to say. So lastly, of all the things that kind of stood out to me in this book, I think the author does a really good job of just highlighting all the different studies that were done on Black people without their consent. I know she brings up the Tuskegee syphilis studies, where basically the government worked with, I think, this school to kind of inject a bunch of African Americans with the syphilis virus and then didn't treat them and just let it run its course even after they had the cure for it. And so that ended up affecting a lot of people, and a lot of people died and a bunch of stuff. So the author, you know, talked about that and a bunch of other different experiments where they kind of did similar things. And I know for me as a graduate student, and also just a student, I think undergrad too, it's psychology, but social work and psychology, we talked about that. And a lot of the times we talk about the Nuremberg Code, which is like a rule that basically states that anytime you're doing any kind of research, there has to be voluntary consent. And then you also have to make sure that the results of these experiments kind of contribute to, you know, the greater good of the society. And then there's a whole bunch of other things that kind of make sure that you're being mindful not to inflict too much like physical or mental suffering on somebody. So like there's a Nuremberg Codes, there's IRB, which is like a group of people that kind of help make sure that whatever you're using test subjects that are human or in vulnerable populations, you're doing it in a way that's ethical. So all of these things are supposed to be there to be checks and balances. But it's so crazy, from the syphilis study to the study she describes of like how they use plutonium, to a study that they described where they used children and injected them with these medications that didn't turn out very well for them, or how they did all this research on prisoners and, you know, gave them LSD and all this stuff. So even though all of these codes and all these rules and all these things are supposed to exist to make sure research is not being done in a way that's harmful to people, especially of how it was in the past, people are still kind of like getting around it somehow and not, you know, subscribing to it and making sure that they're truly giving people informed consent, which is like you're telling people the important information that they need to know about the risk and the benefits of anything, any medical procedure, any treatment or testing or anything as it's going. So at any point of the study, this person is supposed to be allowed to say, nope, I don't want to do this anymore. And it's supposed to be okay, right? So none of that stuff is happening. And I think for me, it was wild because, like, you know, I, coming from a psychology and social work background, like, this is stuff that's, like, drilled, you know, into us, right? We're taught this from the get-go when we're talking about research and studying people and all that stuff. Like, we're taught, like, this is stuff that's drilled and we need to know it, like, the back of our hand. But then to kind of read about how a lot of this stuff, people have like kind of wiped their ass with it and just did whatever they wanted to do, and they're hurting all these people, that was hard for me to sit with, if I'm being honest. So pair that with, you know, what I mentioned at the top about how the author goes into conversations about bioterrorism and, you know, different technologies and things that are happening behind the scenes that we may not know about, and how, again, mixed with, you know, the fact that there's no checks and balances for the way people conduct research and, you know, put shit out into the world and not get our consent, like, I really think like this is shit that if we think too much about, like, nobody's going to be able to sleep. So I'm not going to go too hard in the pain about that. But again, I think, you know, as the author notes, like, it's so important for us to really be talking about these topics and understand the medical system and, you know, hold these people accountable. Because I do think a lot of the times the thing that happens is because we're giving groups of people power and we're saying, hey, you are the voice in this area, sometimes people let that power kind of get into their heads and they forget, you know, their role and why they got into the work initially, right? And I think that's just a human thing, because I know I see it in social work, we see it in churches, we see it as, you know, our government officials. Like, I think a lot of the time people set out to be like, oh, I really do want to change the world and, you know, be a good person and blase, blase, blah. But then somewhere along the way, like, they let power and influence and all this other stuff kind of cloud their judgment. And so Yeah, it's hard. I don't know if there's like a quick fix to this or like a real like concrete like this is what we need to do, but I just know that doing nothing is not the answer, and I think the author is kind of, reminding that of us too, like letting us know like we can't just sit here and do nothing. We have to kind of own and the mistakes and kind of, try to take steps to move forward, So yeah, and so lastly to end, I just want to talk a little bit about, just how this book kind of challenged the way that I kind of, see things around me or the world around me. And so this book, I will say, really challenged a lot of things for me, especially because, like, surprisingly, I'm not really a medical person, even though both of my parents studied at some point to become medical doctors in Costa Rica. Their hope and prayer was for me and my sister to do it as well, but medicine grosses me out. So just in general, learning about medicine and the medical world was challenging for me just because I know n not much about it. But I do think like this book kind of left me with some thoughts and some reflections that I want to kind of invite you guys to think about and reflect on as well. And so the first is this concept of like publication. I think, me being a person with a psychology and social work background. While I was in grad school, I was always kind of turned off by this idea of like everybody is like, oh, I need to get published or do a journal thing or do a poster and go to these conferences and blah, 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 blah. And a lot of it becomes about making a name for yourself. But at the same time, as you're trying to make this name for yourself, you're kind of exploiting the population that you're working with, and that like you're using them to get data, you're using them to get your program, talked about and started and blah, blah, blah. But a lot of the times, like after these researchers and stuff are done getting their data and done with their programming for the sake of doing their presentation or their paper, these populations are forgotten about. And I know for me, that's been something that's kind of irked me for a minute because a good chunk of these populations that are being used are brown and black ones. And so I would often, be sitting there like thinking about, okay, so you guys are learning about how poverty contributes to all these different issues and all this different stuff, but at what point are you this is this data or this stuff that you're doing for these black people or these brown people actually going to be beneficial to them, actually going to lead to some systematic change, right? And sometimes I kind of wonder if part of why we don't try to push for systematic change is because we're so busy trying to find ways to profit o off of their struggle and make papers or build our names off of their struggles that their issues and their plight becomes like an afterthought for real, And I'm not saying that this is true of everybody because there are some great programs and some great things that sometimes come out of research. But I think, again, because a lot of this stuff, really doesn't lead to systematic change, I get very wary of this, this whole cycle of, okay, let's go back to this community, do all these research projects and blah, 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 write our papers. And then, the student leaves and then the program is gone and their funding is gone and these people are no longer important or relevant, right? I get wary of that. And I think it's not only, insulting to the people in that neighborhood, but it's also, I don't know, just insulting in general to humanity because, it's because us not helping those neighborhoods and us not helping those people, it hurts our country as a whole, even though we don't really see it that way. So that's one thing where I was like, ooh, and just seeing how it's been a cycle of like constantly these different doctors, these different researchers have used these bodies of African Americans to just, further their research, build their names, build their wealth and all this stuff, and then, you know, kind of see how a lot of that has continued on in our present day. Part of me is like, how are we any different? You know, I mean, I will say that as far as I can see, you know, there are a lot of programs and stuff that are very good about informed consent, and they're not just pumping people with some stuff. You know, there are some good ones out there. I'm not saying all of them are bad, but in the sense that we're not different because, again, we're using these people's bodies to build our platforms, to build our wealth, to build our prestige and all this other stuff. And then once we're done using them, it's like they no longer exist or no longer relevant. And I know for me, that's an area now where I'm like, I don't know how much I want to be a person that's producing and publishing stuff like that, because that's not why I signed up for this work. That's not why I like social work or why I wanted to do therapy and all that stuff. And even if I ever consider going back to school for a PhD, I don't want that to be like where I get lost, that I'm so constantly so focused on just like creating papers, that I don't remember that these people are real people, that they have lives, that they have dreams and hopes. And it's more than just being like a guinea pig or a subject to my research study, right? So that's one of the things. And so the next thing that kind of stood out to me, I think it kind of connects to the books that I did previously on sexual assault and just what women go through. I did see a lot in this book of like how white men justified raping black women and black girls by saying like, oh, they're, you know, built, their bodies built to be hypersexual and, you know, all this horrible language when it's like, this is a little kid. What do you mean? Right? I saw a lot of that. And I think, you know, just thinking about the black community a little bit, and like especially Miss Tarana Burke's story and how people reacted to her, you know, experiencing sexual assault, and like the little girls that she worked with also. I think for black people, this thought came up is like, we're kind of using like the same crap that the slave owners used on us when they try to justify, you know, us being raped, us being sexually assaulted and all this stuff. Like, we are here saying, oh, well, you know, she's just fast or she's developed, she's this. And it's like, this is a child. And even if they're older, like, that's wrong. And so I guess, like, that's something that kind of stood out to me, too, is like, I think, you know, that might be something that we need to explore in the black community, maybe in other communities as well. It's like, we're kind of using the slave master's language to justify sexual assault and stuff, where it's like, no, this is just wrong, and you have no self-control, and you're rapey, and that's it. Like, there's no reason to blame the other person. So that was just like a quick thought that I had when I was reading this. And then I think related to sexual assault and like women's health and stuff, I was wondering too, like one of the chapters brought up a lot about Roe versus Wade and eugenics and the use of the pill and like hysterectomies and all this stuff to kind of stop black people from producing, right? And so I think it's really interesting that at some point of history, white people were like, yeah, let's use the pill, let's use hysterectomies and maybe even abortions for all I know to stop the blacks from reproducing. But then I think like slowly as white people started, you know, using some of this stuff to not have kids, I'm wondering if like that's where the alarm kind of started going off, right? And so again, this was kind of just like a one-off thought, but I was just kind of wondering, like, is it that, you know, white people, are you guys like more concerned or upset about the fact that Roe versus Wade and abortions and all this thing is a thing because white people or white women are not having kids, and because there's so many more brown and black ones kind of hanging around in the U.S., like now it's a point of alarm, especially, I don't know, I think especially since, you know, a lot of this stuff really was birthed out of like eugenics and keeping the United States pure and white and all this stuff. I don't know. That was just a thought that I had as I was reading this. And it kind of made me want to, you know, explore more about that topic and learn more. And of course, you know, I could be full of shit, or maybe it's just, you know, something that I could be half right about. I don't know. But I think that was something that made me kind of challenge my thinking around the topic, especially as a Christian, because I know my whole life it's just been like, oh, Roe versus Wade and abortion is wrong and we need to overturn it. Like, that's always the conversation all the time. But I think, like, as I've gotten older, obviously, like, I'm trying to do more critical thinking around the topic of abortion and pro-choice, pro-life and all this stuff. But I don't know, after reading this, the chapter where she does talk a lot about the eugenics, and, you know, especially around that quote that I mentioned earlier about how these people were kind of seen as like dogs that you had to neuter. Again, I'm wondering if, like, with white people, if this only really became a question when these dogs that were being neutered were white women that were not producing more white offspring, and not about neutering black and brown people. You know, so that's something to think about. But I did love that the author kind of brought up in this chapter too, this quote where she said, within a century, reproduction coercion had taken a 180 degree turn for black women. During slavery, black women had been forced to procreate. Now they were being forced into sterility. The consistent factor was white control. And so I did think that was like a sentence that I was like, oh, wow. Like, I am floored by this, you know, observation in some ways, because it's true. Like, black women went from a place where it's like, oh, like, I think Thomas Jefferson said, like, if a black woman can produce at least like one baby or so every 2 years, like, they're valuable, right? And then now you're going to, you know, flipping it around to, oh, we need to force them not to have kids anymore. We need to neuter them. We need to neuter them like you neuter a puppy, whatever. Like, that switch is like, whoa. Like, and obviously it's like, now having so many black and brown people in this country is not profitable in the same way that it was. So now it's like, we have to stop it. And again, it's back to this conversation about pro-life, pro-choice. Like, you know, is this really what it's really coming, like, what it's really about? Like, are you really that concerned about the sanctity of life? Or are you just trying to get white women to have kids again? Because there's too many brown and blacks out here. I don't know. That's a deep one. And then lastly, I just wanted to, you know, mention this last thought that she brought that kind of provoked my way of thinking a little bit. She mentions on page 21, of the, kind of in the beginning of the book, she says, a paranoid label is often affixed to blacks who are weary of participating in medical research. However, not only is paranoid a misnomer, but it is also symbolic of a dangerous misunderstanding. That is why I refer to African American fears of medical professionals and institutions as iatrophobia, coined from the words iatros, which is healer, and phobia, which means fear. Black iatrophobia is the fear of medicine. And so I think for this quote, and the reason I bring it up is because, like, this book and this idea of iatrophobia really forced me to think about blackness and medicine together, like, differently. Because I know even within my scope of work and social work, there's always like these, you know, vignettes that they do about, oh, black people usually react to us like blah, blah, blah. But it never really accounts for the fact that, you know, social workers were used a lot of the time, especially black and brown social workers too, sometimes were used to trick black people into certain things sometimes, certain research studies. I know there's also a part where she brings up in the chapter that, you know, certain programs, like, they wouldn't give black women money if they knew that you had a black man in the house, right? It was encouraged that the family be broken apart to keep you on welfare, to keep you on certain things. And then at the same time, then you were known as like a welfare queen, and that came with its stuff, right? So I think like basically like this natural distrust of anybody in these different positions, whether you're a social worker, therapist, you know, doctor, even people that are working in foster care, adoption, all of these different things. Like, it's natural that there's this natural like mistrust, because throughout the years, like, we've asked these people to trust us and we're not really facilitating, you know, a reason for them to trust us. We're not really encouraging them to trust us with our actions, right? And so for me, this book was like an eye-opener, not only because like all I really knew about was like the syphilis study, really, but then to know about all these other things and to just wrestle with the fact that this is like really a part of our history. And it's like, I'm also part of like the medical slash helping field in some ways. So now with all of this in mind, it's like, what am I going to do differently? Or what can I empower other people or inspire other people to do differently? And honestly, it's a lot to sit with, because I do agree with Miss Washington that, you know, a lot of these black people, including myself, we do have a reason to be like, ooh, I don't know if I can trust these spaces to have my best interest to really care about me. I know even like right now I work in a hospital and I'm like, I wouldn't trust you guys really with my life. And it's sad that I have to say that, but you know, but it's the reality. So it's like, how can we like move forward from this? How can we work together to ensure that everybody can feel safe in these medical spaces, right? And I think the reality is like, there is really probably not a like quick fix. It's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of time and patience. But I think what this book is inspiring me to do and inspiring us to think about is like, it's something that's possible. It just takes time. It takes honesty. It takes us really coming together and talking all of this stuff out, right? And so I thank you guys so much for just listening to me talk about this book. This episode ended up being a lot longer than I expected it to be. So that's why I ended up making it a two-parter. But I do hope that as you've listened to both parts, that you were able to kind of learn something, and that you feel inspired to go out and pick up this book. And you know, if you need to read it in sections, I know for me, I like to listen to these books sometimes, so I did it through Audible. And even though the first few chapters were a little bit tough to digest, especially with the stuff with Dr. Sims and the slavery and like all the loops that these people went to justify their horribleness, you know, there was a lot of this book that I really was like, wow, this is a good book. This lady really went in and she, you know, did the work that a lot of us should be doing, especially if you're in the medical field. And I love, like, again, that, you know, as a black woman, she wasn't afraid to be like, I'm gonna blow this whistle. I'm gonna have these honest conversations with these people to put this book together, and I don't care what you guys think about it. And so I'm very thankful to Mrs. Washington for this. I can't imagine like having like what she had to read, how much of this stuff she had to read, and how hard it must have been to have to read all of these studies and different things and just find a way to, you know, make this into a concise book. Because again, I know even the stuff that I read, I was like, oh, this is rough. So I can only imagine. But I'm very thankful for this woman and her work in this book. And I encourage you guys to go out and pick it up, whether it's a hard copy, Audible, or whatever, pick it up, listen to it, read it, and, you know, try to learn from this experience. And to end, I just want to read a quote that I thought was really good that kind of, you know, summarizes why it's so important for us to have these conversations and read books like this. And the quote is basically this: the wrongs which we seek to condemn and punish have been so calculated, so malignant, and so devastating that civilization cannot tolerate their being ignored because it cannot survive their being repeated. Chief U.S. Prosecutor Robert Jackson opening statement, Nuremberg Doctors Trials, December 9, 1946. And so I felt like this was an important statement to read because, like I mentioned, the Nuremberg Codes ended up being something that they created to make sure horrible atrocities wouldn't happen again. And I think it was created after everything that was going on with World War II and the Nazis and the experimentation that they were doing, right? And so even then, like, they recognized, like, all the horrible medical and research stuff that they were doing on those humans back then, it was unacceptable. And for that stuff to be continuing on in different ways throughout our country and other countries, we can't afford to not say anything. We can't afford to not punish it. We can't afford to turn a blind eye to it, because if we do, it's to the detriment of our society, right? And so I hope that we remember that as we, you know, continue on in our day-to-day, as we reflect on books like this, that we really need to be willing to stand up for what's right and challenge these systems that ignore the horribleness of this stuff, right? And so with that said, I thank you all so much for listening to this episode of Critical Reads Podcast, and I'll see you all again next week. Please enjoy my outro. Hey there, and thank you for joining me on this week's episode of Critical Reads. To find out more about me or to consume more of my content, please feel free to visit my website, soulsessionswithneff.com, where I share a variety of things, including blog posts, resource lists, and have a regularly updated calendar for this podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook using the handle @soulsessionswithneff. While you're at it, if you really enjoy listening to Critical Reads, I encourage you to please subscribe to this show on iTunes, Google, or Spotify, and take some time to rate us on these different platforms. Your reviews will really help the show gain some visibility and also give me some much-needed feedback on how the show is doing. I thank you in advance for your time and your support, and until next time, this has been Neff with some Critical Reads.